Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For sale on this Monday, 11,000 apartments on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Not for sale, really, so much as about to go into foreclosure. The biggest real estate deal in this country ever has gone bad, and that cannot possibly be a good thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, and it is great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 25th of January today. You know, you can blame the banks for not lending, or you can blame the stubbornly high unemployment rate. Whatever the reason, the real estate market is still suffering. A report out this morning showed sales of existing homes, or used homes, if you feel that way about it, it fell sharply last month. But if the residential market looks bad, the commercial market looks all the worse. We have told you about homeowners walking away from their mortgages, right? Today, we learned a big development company has walked away from the most expensive single residential property deal ever made in the United States, an 11,000-unit development in New York City called Stuyvesant Town. Developers took a $4.5 billion loan out to buy it a couple of years ago. Now, the market being what the market is, they can't make their payments, and so they have called it quits. Marketplace's Elisa Roth says the same scenario is playing out all over the country.
In some ways, the Stuyvesant Town story is uniquely New York. But part of it is pretty universal. When real estate was booming, banks all over the country made big loans to property developers. And now, those borrowers are having a hard time making payments. Richard Parkus is head of commercial real estate debt research at Deutsche Bank. He says this is just the beginning of the shakeout, because there are still a lot of commercial loans that need to get rewritten.
And that may entail the foreclosure and liquidation of properties and new loans being written on those properties, new buyers owning those properties.
Parkus says we're in for a volatile stretch in commercial real estate.
Whether this will lead to sort of another, turning point downward in the economy, I don't believe it will.
But even if the wider economy isn't at risk, community and regional banks already are. That's because many are highly exposed to commercial real estate loans. Sam Chandon is CEO of Real Estate Econometrics. It's a research firm. He says those banks are also often the most important lenders in their communities.
So whether it be a loan for a small home improvement, whether it be a loan to help you open a business, whether it be an education loan, there are all sorts of mechanisms for accessing credit that depend upon healthy community and regional banks.
And he says bad commercial real estate loans have helped put dozens of these banks out of business already. If commercial borrowers continue to default or walk away, we'll see many more. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Continuing with a theme here, you remember the phrase toxic assets from the good old days of the credit crisis? They are still around, and every time the government seizes a failed bank, we taxpayers own more of them. The FDIC took over 5 banks just last Friday. So what's it going to do with all the bad assets the banks have on their books? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains one idea that's being thrown around today.
The FDIC says it's considering packaging up the loans it now owns and then selling securities to private investors. Bill Isaac is a former chairman of the FDIC. He now heads LECG Global Financial Services. He says the plan sounds familiar.
The FDIC packaged up a lot of assets from failed banks and SNLs in the 1980s and early 1990s, sold them off into the markets. It was really quite a successful program to get the assets back into private sector hands.
But who on earth would want to buy these securities? I asked Marilyn Cohen, the author of Bonds Now, Making Money in the New Fixed Income Landscape. She says even cautious investors could bite if they do their homework.
And they would figure out, you know, which of the underlying portfolio are going to fail, which are going to succeed, and you buy them at a discount, and you don't need, you know, 100% or even 80% to succeed in order to make a lot of money.
All this optimism makes you wonder, if the FDIC goes ahead with this and it works, will surviving banks finally be able to sell off their supposedly toxic assets? Cassandra Torian says not so fast. She's president of Bellrock Capital.
I mean, remember, these banks still have the issue of cleaning up the balance sheet versus what it does to their capital ratios.
Or put simply, it's unclear how big of a loss banks are willing to take if they sell. That's a question even the most plugged-in investors still can't answer. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
A David and Goliath story for you now via the commercial aviation industry. This one has a twist, though. Two Goliaths against one David. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
In one corner are the world's biggest jet plane makers, Europe's Airbus and Boeing of the U.S. These fierce competitors have become allies to keep a Canadian newcomer from cutting into their sales of smaller jets. Bombardier has plans to market a 150-seat jet, one that would compete directly with Boeing and Airbus. Boeing's John Kwasniewski says Canada is unfairly underwriting Bombardier's small jet with export subsidies.
Both Airbus and Boeing share the fact that it is being offered as a competitor to large airplane products and thus should be subject to the same fee structure for large airplanes.
But unfair government subsidies are the complaint that Airbus and Boeing usually throw at each other, says University of Portland professor Richard Gritta.
That is, to me, the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, when it benefits Boeing or it benefits Airbus, they kind of say, well, it's okay. But now they're seeing somebody else try it against them. They don't like it.
Boeing and Airbus are working on a new international agreement to limit government support for aircraft exports. The Teal Group's Richard Abulafia says they have to act fast because other competitors aren't far behind.
I think there's a real fear at Airbus and Boeing that if Canada can basically get government support to enter their turf, then so can Russia, China, and whoever else wants to play there too.
Smaller jets are more efficient and safer than the turboprop planes regional carriers use now. Analysts forecast a 40% increase in demand over the next decade. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Choppy might be a good word to describe Wall Street today. Positive would as well, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a big Haiti meeting happening in Montreal, Canada today, a planning session for how to organize international aid in the months and years to come. We will talk about that in just a couple of minutes. First, though, a look at the present and future of the Haitian economy. Most of it has been destroyed, and as the rescue work on the ground turns into recovery, Sabri Benachour reports that the country's businesses are going to need as much relief as its people.
There's a market near the sea in Port-au-Prince. Vendors, women mostly, sit behind fruits and vegetables piled in neat little stacks on the bare dirt under the shade of driftwood and sheet metal. This market wasn't too badly damaged in the earthquake, precisely because it's made of such flimsy, light material. This is just about at the bottom of Haiti's economy, but it's a big part of that economy.
Manioc, tomate, piment, pomme de terre.
Solange Jean is selling cassava, potatoes, and pumpkins on the sidewalk. She says she was among the first to return to the market 2 days after the earthquake hit.
The country is destroyed. My house is destroyed. I lost 10 members of my family. There is no more business because everybody that survived went out of town. So there's no business, there's no money.
Solange gets her produce from the countryside, but she says that's getting harder.
It's more and more expensive. There is no fuel, no transport, and the people that bring these things to me are few now.
I ask if people have been trying to barter more and more. Not more than usual, she says.
We are a poor country. Bartering is normal.
And as she sits on the ground, thousands of flies swarming around her, she admits there are people even poorer than she.
Sometimes I just give people my vegetables because I can see there is just no way they can pay.
But setting up a pile of vegetables on the street is a lot easier than rebuilding a three-story supermarket. Larger companies will be a lot slower and a lot more expensive to rebuild, if they rebuild at all.
We lost about 15 buildings, and we have about 50 buildings.
Richard Lebrun is part of one such business, the Mevs Group, a Haitian company that runs this major port. On one side, crews are trying to repair broken piers. On the other, medevac helicopters are evacuating earthquake victims to hospital.
We know we have to rebuild, but frankly, we don't see how we're going to get out of it because, you know, banks are not lending money right now. It's very capital intensive, and it's a very long payback period.
It's hard to finance construction in Haiti, Lebrun says, because rents are so cheap.
We definitely do not have the means to do that kind of investment. And without outside help, without foreign direct investment, or without grants or long-term financing, it's close to impossible to rebuild.
The Mevs Group was going to build a major industrial park with international aid, but money for new projects will have to wait for old ones to be rebuilt. And that is Haiti's economic problem writ large.
They are pulling resources that were originally pledged for development into responding to the crisis.
Pamela Cox is the regional vice president for Latin America and the Caribbean at the World Bank.
Because of this crisis, because of the four hurricanes it faced in August, because of the food crisis it faced in April 2008, each time Haiti faces a crisis like this, they are robbing Peter to pay Paul.
There are glimmers of hope. There will be reconstruction jobs. New construction will likely be stronger and more energy efficient. But that's a very expensive glimmer. The UN estimates the quake will cost Haiti 25% of its GDP. Cox says foreign disaster aid at $1 billion pledged so far will likely not be enough to keep Haiti's future development from being set back by decades. From Port-au-Prince, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
About that aid Sabri mentioned just now, the billion or so pledged so far and the billions more surely to come. Secretary of State Clinton and representatives of other likely donor countries are meeting in Montreal today, trying to decide what to do from here. Robert Fox is the executive director of Oxfam Canada. We reached him on the sidelines of that conference up north. Mr. Fox, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
This conference today isn't really a donors conference proper. It's more a planning conference to figure out how much and what kinds of aid are going to be raised. Is that right?
That's right. The critical thing today is to establish two general areas of principle. One is that Haitians will be providing the leadership and ownership of this process, and that the United Nations will be coordinating the international response to increase Haiti's capacity and support them in that process. And secondly, to sort of scope out the magnitude of the challenge, in a broad sweep, the level of funding that's required and the duration of that funding, that everyone's very clear that this isn't about a quick fix and limited dollars. This is a major commitment over a number of years.
The Prime Minister of Haiti said today he expects the international aid community to be involved in Haiti for at least the next 10 years. You think that's realistic?
I think that's certainly realistic. I think that it may take longer than that. You know, when you consider the magnitude of this disaster, it isn't just that so many people were killed and such economic devastation was wrought upon Haiti. It is that it was such a large portion of such a small pie. And so the state infrastructure, the social infrastructure, and the economic infrastructure of the city, of the country, has been decimated.
Will the international aid community address the very fundamental issue of whether you rebuild Haiti as it was or if you redesign that country to make it more than it is and has been?
Well, certainly what we've been pressing is that we need to be really clear about the fact that basically we need to reimagine Haiti. If at the end of this process we rebuild the Haiti that existed 2 weeks ago, that will have been a failure. A country that had huge problems, huge inequity, huge levels of poverty, and obscene levels of child mortality.
The billions of dollars that will be raised, Mr. Fox, who's going to decide how they get spent?
Well, at the end of the day, it's really important that it be the Haitian government and Haitian civil society, with the support of the Haitian diaspora, that make those decisions. This is not a plan that can be made in Montreal. This is not a plan that can be made in Washington. This is a plan that needs to be made by Haitians if they're going to have the ownership of the process.
But the choices that the Haitian government has made in the past and that Western aid groups and countries have made in the past on behalf of Haitians have worked out not so well.
That's true. And we don't want to replicate our mistakes in the past. We need to move forward with confidence, but with some humility into the future.
Robert Fox, he's the executive director of Oxfam Canada. We reached him in Montreal today at an aid conference for Haiti. Mr. Fox, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Take care.
Coming up, send in the clowns.
People working with me and for me, they see that I'm most of the time laughing, smiling, and happy. I think it's a strength.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 23 points today, nearly a quarter of 1%, finished at 10,196. The NASDAQ added 5 points, also a quarter percent, closed at 2210. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, a half percent, ended the day at 1096. Financial companies rebounded slightly today in light trading. Wells Fargo cashed in a gain of nearly 1.5%. Goldman Sachs and Bank of America each up more than 0.5%. Citigroup down 0.6%, though. Philips Electronics powered up 7% after announcing a profit for the third straight quarter. Ticketmaster and Live Nation each charged up about 15% after the U.S. Justice Department approved a merger between the two ticket brokers. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.63%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Congressional Budget Office releases its 2010 Budget and Economic Outlook. The Federal Reserve discusses interest rates and the economy at its first regularly scheduled meeting of the year. And what do you think about the economy? The Conference Board releases its monthly consumer confidence survey on attitudes towards spending. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Every now and then, when you're doing your grocery shopping, you get lucky, and there's somebody giving out a free sample of the latest chicken teriyaki or pumpkin cheesecake or whatever. If you happen to shop at one of the big warehouse discounters like Costco or Sam's Club, those freebies are pretty much an everyday thing. That is why the news this weekend that Sam's Club is going to let 10,000 people go, many of them freebie giver-outers, it was kind of jarring. First of all, Sam's Club had 10,000 people giving out samples and doing product demos. And also, who's going to give out all the free tastes when those people are gone? Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Eddie Halpern finds product demos kind of annoying. They clog up the aisles at the Sam's Club where he shops in New Orleans. But even Halpern couldn't resist free veggie chips.
I ended up buying them, and I think it was probably because of the whole, you know, mental aspect of seeing it and tasting it and saying, well, you know, might as well grab a bag of that.
Sam's Club isn't ditching the free samples and product demos. Instead, the Walmart subsidiary is hiring an outside company called Shopper Events to manage them. Supermarket analyst Phil Lempert says nothing sells products better than samples.
There's no replacement for free food. So if you can get especially a new product in someone's mouth and then hand them a high-value coupon at the same time, the incidence of them turning into a consumer, that shopping trip is enormously high.
Sam's Club says outsourcing its demos is about improving sales, not cutting costs. Retail consultant George Whalen isn't buying it. Earlier this month, Walmart said it would close 10 Sam's Club stores and cut 1,500 jobs. Whalen says the company wants sample-driven sales without the hassle and expense.
They've got to worry about scheduling these people, and they've got to worry about making sure that people show up. And if they don't show up, they've got to get some more people to come in and do it. It's just a management headache.
Sam's Club says the 10,000 mostly part-time workers affected can reapply for jobs at shopper events. Another 1,200 people who recruit new members will also lose their jobs. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Two and a half years ago, when the credit crisis was just starting to get a lot of attention and the economy was just starting to slow down, in pretty much every interview I did, I asked some version of this question. When is it going to start to get better? The answer was always, so about 6 or 9 months, maybe. And then 6 months later, I would ask the same question. When is it going to start getting better? And the answer was, oh, 6 months, maybe nine. Drove me nuts. Commentator and economist Justin Wolfers knows the feeling.
Larry Summers, the head of the National Economic Council, recently said, quote, "Everybody agrees that the recession is over." But by everybody, he meant economists. The public disagrees. A recent Gallup poll found that nearly half of all Americans believe that economic recovery won't begin for at least another 3 years. What gives? It turns out that we're all using the same words, but we each mean different things. And the definitions turn out to be critical. The National Bureau of Economic Research provides the economist definition. They say that a recession ends when the economy reaches its trough. That means that the start of a recovery isn't a bright point, but rather the low point. If the recession has ended and the recovery has just begun, it is only because things have gotten as bad as they're going to get. So it actually makes sense that things still feel dismal, even as economists declare the recovery underway. But Joe Public's definition of recovery is when the economy has returned to some level of good health. Perhaps he'll call it a recovery when we recover the 9 million jobs that have disappeared in recent years. The public are interested in the level of the business cycle. Professional economists talk about its changes. And these days, things are even more complicated because the news is reporting the slowing rate at which we're losing jobs. That's a change in a change. Fortunately, Obama's chief economist, Christina Romer, has sorted out this linguistic kerfuffle. She recently said, quote, "There's the official definition, and that talks about just when do you turn the corner. And we have, at least in terms of GDP, reached that point. But," she said, "you're not recovered until all those people that want to work are back to work." So to cut through all this economic verbiage, the bottom line is this. We are recovering. But this doesn't mean we can ease up on economic stimulus, because we're still a heck of a long way away from being recovered.
Justin Wolfers is an associate professor of business and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Share your thoughts about what you hear on the broadcast or what drives you nuts or whatever. Marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. French workers are no strangers to the powers of organized labor. Strikes and walkouts are a fairly common occurrence in France. At a steel factory in the eastern part of the country this week, employees took it one step further, though they have basically kidnapped four supervisors in a dispute over layoffs. They're not letting them leave until some kind of deal on labor force is made. In Paris, there's an ad campaign running that is trying to get workers to take more risks, although of a more entrepreneurial kind. John Lawrenson reports.
Commuters streaming into the Paris metro passed a curious new poster campaign. There are four different posters, four different clowns, three men and one woman, looking straight at you. They've got bowler hats, curly wigs and thick black and white makeup, but no mention of a product, just an internet address. Je suis un clown.com, I am a clown.com. There you'll find uplifting stories of entrepreneurs who've risked everything and suffered ridicule to make their dream jobs come true. One of the business people who clowned up for the campaign is Pierre Aski.
I used to work in a daily newspaper, and when I told my editor, I was the deputy editor, and I told my editor that I was leaving to create an online newspaper, he told me, "You're mad." So he could not imagine that I would jump into a totally unknown world. People thought we were crazy.
The entrepreneurs in this campaign all work in areas where the digital revolution is making and breaking fortunes: news, the movies, retailing and communication. The campaign is to encourage people to take career risks, to believe in themselves and their ideas. In a country where opinion polls show what people care about most are job security and a secure pension, this campaign is selling the idea of self-starting businesses the American way. Anne-Laure Constanza launched an online retail site for pregnant women called EnvieDeFraise.com, StrawberryCraving.com. The reaction she got was anything but "go on, girl."
Here, when you tell your mother you're starting up a company, she starts to frown and to pray. So I think, yes, I think French people have more fear to fail.
What people need to understand, Constanza says, is that losing is part of playing the game. She says there's opportunity to be had in failure. Looking like an idiot with your foot stuck in a bucket of water is what being a clown is all about. Grégoire Lassalle is another of this campaign's clowns. He's now the CEO of Allociné, France's biggest internet cinema listing service. But his first job for 7 years was, wait for it, professional clown. And clown, he says, he still is, even if he now employs 100 people in offices on the Champs-Élysées.
People working with me and for me, they see that I'm most of the time laughing, smiling and happy. I think it's a strength. I try to not be too much serious, and even if it's a business and a hard business, my approach with people is like a clown, I think.
Back in the metro, these ads are catching people's attention, and LaSalle says if only 15 people are inspired to take a chance and start a company, the campaign will have been worthwhile. In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Clowning itself can be a serious business. To learn one of its unwritten rules, check out our new online feature. It's called the Daily Nugget. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, you know, it has been 20 years since you've been able to get a good haggis in this country. Haggis, of course, being the Scottish national dish. You take a sheep's stomach, you stuff it with oats, sheep fat, onion, spices, and other assorted leftover bits of the animal, including its lungs. You simmer for a couple of hours and you serve. I'm told it's actually quite tasty somehow. Anyway, 20 years ago, Washington banned certain meat imports from the UK, including those leftover bits, from animals that might have been infected with mad cow disease, like sheep's. Or sheep. That brings us to this January 25th, Burns Night, as it is known to devotees of the Scottish poet Robert Burns. The BBC reports that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is set to lift its limit on those imported meats. Sadly, though, for all you haggis lovers, we did call the Ag Department. They said they are looking at their mad cow ban, just not haggis specifically. Also, no timeline for when you might be able to, you know, eat that stuff. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 23 points, a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ added 5 points, also a quarter percent. The S&P 500 up 5 points, a half percent. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this broadcast, as the World Economic Forum kicks off in Davos, are attendees hoping to save the world or just their own companies?
It was a place to do business. If you asked me how much did I contribute to improving the state of the world, I'm afraid my scorecard may be pretty empty.
Ah, good to know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.